I don't think you derive technical rules or interpretive strategies from a theory. I think what we do instead is try to be as open-minded and available and resonant with what's happening in the room with the patient as we possibly can, while trying to maintain a rich world of associational potentials in the back of our mind.
Welcome to the IPA Podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Hi, welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Robert Michaels. Dr. Michaels has been a training analyst at the Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research in New York. He has served as the Dean of Cornell University Medical College, Provost for Medical Affairs at Cornell. He's a longstanding chairman of the department at Cornell. He's really been a leader in psychoanalysis and psychiatry. He's past president of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, past president of the American College of Psychiatrists, past president of the American Association of Chairmen of Departments of Psychiatrists. You're getting the picture. He's also been an active editor. He's a former deputy editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry, former joint editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, and he's been a member of many editorial boards, including the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association, Psychoanalytic Quarterly, and I can go on and on. What strikes me about our conversation is that when you take all those experiences and all those skills and you titrate it down to the essence of Bob Michaels as a clinician, what you get is his exquisite attunement to what happens in the psychoanalytic dyad, what happens in the analyst and what happens in the analyst, and how can one best understand what it is happening for the benefit of the patient, for the growth of the patient. All these vast experiences really are at their essence in that clinical moment. And I found it a pleasure to hear his journey in psychoanalysis, to understand his thinking about it, and as always, to learn from him. I hope you enjoy my conversation as well. Bob, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you with us. Bob, you have worked in the most significant levels of organized psychiatry, academic medicine, and psychoanalysis. And for the many years you've held these positions, has allowed you to not only learn deeply about each of the fields, but also, and I think more importantly, to appreciate the interface between them. How does psychoanalysis interface with psychiatry and academic medicine. Well, you're uniquely positioned to have perspective on that. And that, and you're being 84 years old and practicing analysis for 53 years, certainly qualifies you to be one of the elders of our field. And being an elder, I am interested in what the last half century of psychoanalysis has looked like to you. But before doing that, let's spend a moment on the current day. And by current day, I mean the interface in these fields and what it looks like to you at this point.
First of all, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. I think it's a very important question. It's important in understanding our past and our history. And it's very important in thinking about what the future is going to be like. The question phrased 50 years ago would have been, what's the appropriate interface between psychoanalysis and psychiatry? Freud once said that he didn't want psychoanalysis to become a chapter in a textbook of psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
I've written such a chapter, so I betrayed the master in that regard. But at that time, 50 years ago, when I was a student in both of these fields, psychoanalysis was, in the United States at least, largely a subcategory of psychiatry, but often without formal recognition for that. I was at a meeting of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology when there was an extensive dialogue about whether to have a subspecialty of psychiatry in psychoanalysis, for which there would be board examinations. The psychoanalytic community was unenthusiastic about that because they would have to give up control to non-psychoanalytic psychiatrists who ran the board. I was a bridging person, a member of both, and so in the middle of that fray. The issue has disappeared because psychoanalysis and psychiatry have moved apart from each other. Psychiatry is less linked to psychoanalysis. It's more biologic, less psychosocial. Its theories, its treatments have less to do with psychoanalysis. And it's become more like other medical specialties in that it's become more oriented toward research. It's differentiated researchers and teachers from clinicians, and psychoanalysis at the same time has moved in the opposite direction. A great many of our candidates today in the United States are not psychiatrists, and increasingly the profession is going to be dominated by non-psychiatrist psychoanalysts. Our theories are less linked to the major theories of psychiatry. There's less said about the brain, and more said about meaning and language and symbols and narratives. We're closer to humanities, we're closer to psychology, and we're further from psychiatry. But I think this leaves a very important question that we've never grappled with really before, and that we're going to have to grapple with for our survival, which is, what is our relationship to the world of academia? Our new partners, humanities and psychology, are long regarded as totally traditional members of the academic world, much more than psychiatry, which only belongs because of its tie to medicine. But the psychoanalytic community has been wary about joining the academic world fully because that would involve major changes in how it functions. One major change would be that in the world of academia, leading educational programs are usually linked to universities, but that's quite unusual in the world of psychoanalysis. Another major issue, and a politically very sensitive one, in the world of academia, leadership roles are selected by groups that include members of other disciplines. So the search committee to find the chairman of a department of history might include a sociologist or an economist or a philosopher. But psychoanalytic institutes and communities are loath to allow non-analysts to participate in their selection of leadership. So there are various important unresolved issues in this. My own view, however, is that the failure to become an academic discipline will be the death knell for psychoanalysis in the long run.
Let me ask you a question about this, related to the issue of who decides the organizational structure in analysis, if it's in academia. It seems to me that analysis is fundamentally different than all the other academic fields, math, history, biology, English, in that what we prize, the sine qua non, if you will, of clinical analysis, is an affective experience. We can call it many things. We could call it the transference experience. We can call it remembering the past. But really, one way to characterize it is the clinical discovery of the past living in the present. That's a profound experience for those fortunate enough as analysts to have it, where we discover that what we think we're doing now is something we're doing now, but we're also doing driven by unknown remnants from the past. And once you make that discovery affectively in the office, you then have options to do it one way or do it the other way. That's a very difficult concept. It's not a concept, it's an experience to present to a tenure committee for promotion. I mean, that doesn't translate to the rigors of academia. And I don't know how one bridges that.
I don't think that problem is unique to psychoanalysis. So every discipline has certain unique characteristics which aren't expected to be fully understood or comprehended or mastered by other disciplines. But in the academic world, it's assumed that you can explain what the issue is and acquaint an educated committee of scholars to understand what these issues are and therefore to participate, not control, not be dominant, but participate. The problem is, if you don't do that, you have a very powerful centrifugal force, which means that the disciplines and the subjects of academia will move further and further away from each other until the coherence of our academic world is lost. The selection of the chairman of a history department can include an economist and a French literature scholar who themselves aren't historians, but can enrich the selection of that chairman. And if it's left up to only historians, there's a danger that history will move further and further away from the rest of the academic world. I think psychoanalysis is struggling with that problem now. And if we insist that we're unique and no one can participate in these dialogues, then we will end up, as we are drifting toward, a cluster of freestanding trade schools where no one in the rest of the academic world understands or respects what we do. I think that would be tragic.
That allows us to segue into how we got to where we are. And as I mentioned, you've been an active participant in the world of psychoanalysis for half a century. It's hard to say walk us through it, but walk us through it. What have you observed for the field, for yourself, for how you and it have changed?
Well, first of all, things have changed.
Things have changed, as they should.
Things have changed. I'm 53 years older than I was 53 years ago, And I'm aware of that. So are my patients. I had a funny episode with a patient a few years ago, a very bright young woman who was a psychologist and was in analysis and had a good sense of humor. And I forgot something. I forgot the name of a member of her family, the proper name. And it was a bit of a sign, maybe, of the memory changes you find at a certain point in life. And she was hesitant in her next comment. And I half jokingly said, "I guess you're afraid that I have early Alzheimer's disease." And she replied, I didn't say early. I remember it very, very clearly. I don't think I have early Alzheimer's disease.
I understand that. I don't think you do either.
But I'm aware of changes in myself over that time, changes in aging and maturity and having a world of experience behind me. Mm-hmm. I'm also aware of changes in the world of psychoanalysis that are, I think, very important, and I'll go into for a bit. When I was a candidate, I think the general view was you learned psychoanalytic theory, and then you applied that theory in the technique of analysis and in the construction of interventions, of interpretations, in understanding dynamics. I think today, many analysts, I would include most younger ones, and in this area, I guess I'm still young, have changed that view considerably. So I don't think you derive technical rules or interpretive strategies from a theory. I think what we do instead is try to be as open-minded and available and resonant with what's happening in the room with the patient as we possibly can, while trying to maintain a rich world of associational potentials in the back of our mind. That would include psychoanalytic theories, but it would include a knowledge of what are the issues going on in the world, and also a knowledge of literature and the arts and other fields of human knowledge, so that we have an array of possibilities in our association to what the patient is saying. And our interventions would be drawn from that large array, more determined by our associative trends and preconscious impulses than by following a rule or deriving a principle from a general theory. That's a change in our notion of what we do. It's one of the changes away from the natural science model that was dominant when I was a candidate and that has diminished in its power today. And it's also one of the changes that opens up the field. When I was a candidate, I think we were concerned that we didn't want to be logically inconsistent in the various things we said to a patient. Frankly, I don't care if I'm logically inconsistent today. Mm-hmm. Sure. If I am, I'd love to explore it, talk about it, think about it, but I don't think the goal is to be logically, coherently organized like a Euclidean geometric proof. That's not the way analysis works. And that's a radical change in the basic model of what psychoanalysis is about.
Given how challenging what you just described is, and I share your sense that that would be perhaps called the standard of practice, that's a tall order for people trying to learn a new skill. I mean, students often understandably seek rules. I mean, the old question of do I answer a patient's question or not? And depending upon what institute or what supervisor or what one's analyst did or does, the person will try to imitate it because they don't otherwise have a sense of what will deepen the moment because they haven't had enough experience. That sometimes answering will deepen the moment and sometimes not answering will deepen the moment. And unless you've had many such experiences confirming or disconfirming your choice, it's hard to immerse yourself in what you just described when you're learning the craft. That's why people begin with rules and eventually evolve to what you just described in terms of being open associatively.
Yes, and I think some of that process has to be an individual development. So I think beginners are going to crave rules, as they do in any field, and the freedom to not be bound by the rules one's learned, but to see them as a source of knowledge and understanding about the wisdom of elders without being bound by them as laws that must be followed, that has to be acquired. So I would say that I'm probably much more likely as a supervisor to cite psychoanalytic theories and rules derived from them than I am when I'm working clinically with a patient.
One of the things you didn't include, which interests me, and I don't think you excluded it on purpose, but it's often not mentioned in describing your associative immersion with the patient, it isn't often where people then use that associative immersion to decide about the usefulness of a prior intervention. It's usually someone will hear, will report something they said, and a supervisor, a colleague, a group will say, oh, that's such a lovely thing to say, or gee, I really think you missed it there. But they will say that before they hear what the patient does with it, which of course is the only confirmation that it was or wasn't useful. And that's often not taught as a tag along to, well, what was the result of your saying it? And I've learned this by working in groups where we have close process material and we really do study the he said, she said of an exchange. And we see that some interventions, even if they don't sound good on their own, nevertheless produce deepening material in the patient's associations. And therefore, it turns out to be clinically useful.
I think I'd be in total agreement with you. The test of an intervention is not whether it's true or false, or not whether it, it is consistent with some psychoanalytic theory. The test is what happens in the process, the result of it, the patient's subsequent associations or resistances or thoughts or whatever. I often tell supervisees that there are two things that don't mean you've said the right thing. One is when the patient says yes, and the other is when the patient says no. Both of those are interesting, but they have much more to do with the transference than the interpretation you just made. What you want to hear is, that reminds me of something.
Sure. I had a dream last night. Funny you say that. Yeah, right.
Exactly. You want to have something new occur in the process.
Am I putting you on the spot to ask you about clinical examples that can demonstrate your changing thinking from then to now?
The answer to the question is simple. Yes, you are.
Yes, yes, I know. Allow me to put you on the spot.
Okay. I'll give you some really trivial examples. I think the heart of psychoanalytic technique is often not in making an Oedipal interpretation or uncovering a memory from the first year of life, but rather in the trivial transactions that go on in the analysis that lead to an aha feeling, a moment of understanding or insight or something like that. So let me tell you a couple of anecdotes. When I was a candidate, I was at a patient who was one of my training cases, and I was seeing him in an office during one of the great New York City blackouts. But my office windows faced New Jersey, where all the lights were still on. So we didn't know there was a blackout. And I knew him quite well, and he knew very little about me because I was following the rules. And when the session ended, he left, and then I was the end of the day for me. I got ready to go, and I left my office and walked outside to where my car was parked and discovered that the entire island of Manhattan was without electricity in the dark. My patient was wandering around. I knew that he didn't have a car. The subways were closed. He had no way to get home. I knew that he lived near me, which was maybe 10 miles away, and I was about to drive back to my home. So I had to make an instant choice. I said hello, and I said, I'm driving downtown. Can I give you a lift? Now, that didn't derive from any psychoanalytic theory I know of, but I felt that to not do that would be less than human in some ways. Afterwards, my supervisor, who was a very good supervisor, was very critical of me for this intervention. She felt that interfered with the possibilities of the transference evolving, and that I disclosed too much. And I disclosed a lot. In the back of the car was a car seat for my little child, but the patient didn't even know I was married or that I had a child, and learned that as soon as he got into the car. My feeling was I would have felt inhuman to let him wander around the northern part of Manhattan Island, unable to get home, Well, I comfortably drove home. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a intervention that I made, which at the time I thought of as a mildly dangerous countertransference enactment, which would put at risk this analysis. Today, I would say...
Before you get to today, let me ask you a question about that, because you're presenting two possibilities. Number one, that it be seen as human, which has a goodness quality to it. And the other is that it would be seen, as the supervisor said, which is hurtful for a very important process for this patient's life.
Exactly.
Now, those are the two theories. But of course, what's missing is what we had just referred to, which is, and so what did you learn? In other words, you have the answer to the question about whether it deepened the treatment or it did not deepen the treatment, which we've agreed is the only standard that really matters. So don't keep us in suspense. What was the outcome of the intervention?
Well, the immediate outcome was we drove home together, and I drove, and he sat in the passenger seat. And he was an intrusive patient who was very curious about me and had reached over and over again the block of my well-trained ability to block his intrusiveness. But here it was difficult, because I'd given him all the evidence ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So he started asking questions. And I took a deep breath, and I took over the dialogue. I think I talked nonstop for the entire trip home. I talked about the weather. I talked about the blackout. I talked about the Yankees that year. I talked about New York City politics. But I didn't let him influence or modify the subject matter we were talking about. And the next day, we had an elaborate discussion of my feeling that I needed to do that to protect my privacy. And I said that to him. Mm-hmm. So it opened up a richer dialogue between us about a previously unarticulated transference, counter-transference theme that was an important issue in the therapy and in his character. I would say that my previous behavior had not gratified his wishes, but had not led to a successful inquiry or analysis about them. And this forced change in my behavior opened things up a little bit.
Which is a really vital point that should be underlined. What you're saying, if I hear you right, is that gratifying a wish became a basis for the discovery of something inside the patient that otherwise remained obscured.
Yes.
It associatively, I can share with you a story that I have a number of physician patients who were at the front lines of this COVID crisis, and at the very beginning of it, and they're really front lines at real risk. And when this was just transpiring, we weren't any longer meeting in my office, but they were meeting with very sick patients daily. And I did something I had never done before, which is I contacted a number of these physicians and I asked how they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And similar to what you said, it had different reactions for different people. For patients who were highly intellectualized and conceived of our meeting as a meeting of minds as opposed to people, it sort of caught them up short. Sort of like, oh, like we're people and you're interested. And like you just said, it opens things up. Others, it made no impact. They said, oh, thank you. And we went on our way. And so it is a different response with each, but it's hard to presume who will respond how. But the idea that it is always dangerous or always beneficial skips the step of our trying to figure out the answer to that question.
Your story reminds me of a current experience of mine. Since the beginning of the pandemic, which now has been going on disastrously in my community for about 4 months, I've been working entirely remotely by Zoom or by telephone. And I've noticed something interesting. A number of patients who are also remote, living in their summer homes or staying locked into their apartments, will begin a session by saying, how are you? Now, not only do my patients begin sessions that way, but my friends and family will begin sure. contact with me that way. Everyone's worried about everyone else's safety and health. Now, if a patient came into my office a year ago and started a session by saying, "How are you?" I would be interested in what that's all about. That's not the way you usually start a therapeutic session or a personal contact necessarily. But today, I would feel it was cold and unfriendly to analyze someone starting a session by saying, "How are you?" in view of the dangers that we're both living in. So I tend today to reply, "I'm well, how are you?" And to treat it as a socially appropriate interaction, then it would be socially inappropriate to push away rather than one that requires immediate inquiry for a deeper possible meaning. That's an adaptation to a new world.
Though at the same time, I guess that if the person asked you that same question every single day of a week, and they asked it in the same sort of ritualized way, at a certain point, you wouldn't just answer it. You'd say, "Let's talk about the question since we just did this yesterday."
Absolutely. It's a good Monday behavior.
Right.
But not necessarily a good Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday behavior.
Right. Bob, you mentioned everybody's asking about each other, and you have certain privileges of being an elder. That is, you've been around, especially around this work, for a very long time. But there are also disadvantages, which is that you're at risk from this illness. Can you share with us a little bit about what life is like being at risk and being in the position you're in?
Sure. I'm 84. I'm in good health. I have risk factors, but no symptoms and no diseases. We're fortunate in that we have a home in the New York City suburbs in a community which has no sidewalks and streets without much traffic on them and lots of space. I haven't left my hometown for 4 months. I do all my work on Zoom or computers or telephone from my office in my home. I take walks every day around the community, but it's so unpopulated that I don't even wear a mask. There's no need to wear a mask. I don't bump into other people. I'm delightfully rewarded by the fact that my daughter and two granddaughters live only 5 minutes away, and they've been wonderfully attentive to their aging grandparents. They do a lot of our food shopping for us, and we'll deliver food to our house each day, which not only is the food nice, but it gives us a chance to see and talk with them, which is very, very nice. So I've been safe, comfortable, worried more about people around me, students, patients, et cetera, than about myself. And maybe not worried as part of my daughter, who's a physician, is more concerned about my following the rules of living in a pandemic and not taking risks than I am. And I keep telling her I have less to lose than she does. There are not that many years left. What difference does it make? But she laughs at that and yells at me to be more careful and gave me as a gift a while back a fancy mask to use when I do go outside the community. So that it's had little personal impact on me, except making other people attentive to my vulnerability and making me aware of their concern and starting me to think about the fact that this may be actually a segue into the beginning of my retirement. And at 84, that's not a crazy thought, but I'm not ready yet.
Do you have a picture of your life in retirement? You've been so busy and active in so many areas.
That's why I'm not ready. I love what I'm doing.
Right.
And I think if someone said, "You don't have to work anymore, you can do absolutely anything you want,"
You'd work. Yeah, I understand. Bob, I don't know if you know this, but I've known you a long time in various capacities. I was a residency director over 35 years ago, and we would interface in the world of academic psychiatry. And you know, I'm not the first to tell you that you have a larger than life presence in many settings, and you certainly did back then for me. And I've known, and we've worked together in various other capacities over these 35 years, and it has been my pleasure to see you, not in the larger than life capacity, but in the very personal capacity with which I appreciate your sharing yourself now with me and the audience. And I have learned from you. I have been inspired by your thoughtfulness. I have been really appreciative of your commitment to the work and how deeply you think about it. And you have been an elder to me over the decades, and I want to thank you for that.
Oh, that's very, thank you. Thank you for saying that. Those are the rewards one gets at a certain point in life, and it's greatly appreciated.
And thanks so much for talking to us today. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.